we come down to her, down in a spatial sense, that is, with Joseph up the river, but down in a temporal sense as well, namely, into the past, where at moderate depth Weisei still lies, still glitters, still resounds with the busy tumult of her streets, still mirrors her temples clear and sharp in the stirless surface of her sacred lakes. And coming thus, we must feel about Weisei a little as we did about Joseph himself, when we first glimpsed beside the fountain that form so besung and belauded in saga and psalm. We traced back the fantastic legend of his loveliness to its source in the opinion of his own time, and found that, even discounting all trumped-up exaggerations, quite enough remained of beauty and of charm. So, too, with No, the heavenly city. It was not compact of any supernal stuff, but built of painted bricks mixed with straw, like any other city. Its streets, as Joseph noted with satisfaction, were as narrow, crooked, foul, and ill-smelling as the streets of any man-made city, large or small, ever have been and will be in this part of the world. At least they were so in the poorer quarters, which, as usual, were much more numerous than the richer sections, these indeed being most spacious and charming. True, it was said and sung, even to the uttermost isles and the coasts beyond, that Weisei's houses were rich in treasure, and in the temples they measured their gold with a scoop. But of such houses there could be but a few, those which Pharaoh had enriched. The great majority held no treasures at all, but were as mean as those of the very island dwellers and denizens of the further coasts, who sunned themselves in the legendary glory of Weisei's fame. As for the size of No, it passed for enormous, and it was. That is, if we add that the word enormous has not one simple, unequivocal meaning, but is a relative conception, depending on who applies it and to what it is applied. For instance, the chiefest monument of Weisei's greatness is a good example of the kind of misunderstanding which can arise. I refer to her reputation as the City of 100 Gates. On Cyprus, Alatia, on Crete, and places yet more remote, she was called, in extravagant awe, the 100-Gated. And it was related that forth from each of these 100 gates, 200 men, with steed and harness, might ride abreast to battle. Such prattle as this took for granted a ring-wall so large round that it could be broken not by 4 or 5, but by 100 city gates, an utterly childish conception, only possible to those who had never seen Weisei with their mortal eyes, but known it only from legend and hearsay. The Amun city might with some justice have been called the Many-Gated, for it had, in fact, many gates, but these were not gates in the sense of sally-ports in the wall. The word referred to the pylons, with which the wearers of the Double Crown had, on the occasions of jubilees and great progresses, from time to time, adorned and complemented the shrines of the gods. For indeed, of these, there were very many, and mighty they were, shining and bright with the colors of their high reliefs and wonder-working inscriptions, blithe with pennants that fluttered above their gilded flagstaffs. And more were added between the time of which I write and the epoch of Weisei's full and incomparable bloom. 100 there were not, either now or later. But 100 is only a round number. Even on our own lips, it often means no more than simply very many. Amun's great dwelling in the north, Epet-Esoet, had, at this time, 6 or 7 such gates, and the smaller temples near it, the houses of Khonsu, Mut, Mont, Min, and the hippopotamus-formed Epet, had several. The other large temple on the river bank, known as Amun's Southern House of Women, otherwise simply the harem, had towered gates too, and still others belonged to the smaller shrines of deities not actually indigenous here, yet settled and provided with nourishment, the houses of Usir and Eset, Ptah of Menphe, Tot, and many more. These temple precincts, with their gardens, groves, and lakes, formed the kernel of the city. They were the city itself, and the dwellings of the profane and human simply filled the spaces between, extending, that is, from the port quarters on the south and Amun's House of Women to the temple complex in the northeast. Across it, lengthwise, ran the great triumphal road of the god, the Ram Sphinx Avenue, which the old man had pointed out to Joseph from the boat. It was a considerable area, and 5,000 ells in length. To the northeast, the triumphal avenue curved landwards, and the residential city filled the widening space between it and the river, while on the other side it spread out toward the eastern desert, where it lost itself in fine gardens and villas, where indeed the houses were rich in treasure. So that in actual fact the city was large, enormous if you like. More than 100,000 people were said to live in it. If 100 was an exaggerated figure for the gates, a sort of poetic license, certainly, on the other hand, 100,000 for the population of Weisei erred on the low side. If we may trust our own estimate, and Joseph's, it was not only larger, but very much larger, even possibly double and treble that figure. Quite definitely so, if one include the inhabitants of the city of the dead over in the west, across the river, called opposite their lord. Not the dead, of course, but those living who dwelt there for professional reasons, having some serious task, either ritual or mechanical, connected with the service of the departed who had gone over the water. These, then, and their dwellings were a city in themselves, which, added to the size of Weisei, made the whole exceedingly large. And among them was Pharaoh himself, who did not live in the city of the living, but without, in the west. On the edge of the desert, under its red rocks, there lay his palace in all its airy grace. And there the pleasure gardens of his palace, with their lake and pleasure waters, which earlier had not been there. A very great city, then. Great, not alone in its extent and the number of its inhabitants, but even more in the intensity of its inner life, and the racial variegations which made it gay and lively like a country fair. Weisei was great as kernel and focus of the world. It considered itself the navel of the world, a piece of presumption in Joseph's eyes, and even otherwise debatable. After all, there was Babel on the Euphrates that flowed the other way. In Babel they were convinced that Egypt's stream flowed the wrong way, and they had no doubt that round about Bab Ilu the rest of the world was grouped in an admiring circle. Though there, too, in respect of building activities, they had not yet reached the fullness of beauty. But it was not without reason that they liked in Joseph's home to say of the Amun city that Nubians and Egyptians without number were their strength, and folk from Punt and Libyans were their auxiliaries. Even on his way with the Ishmaelites from the port to the hostel which lay in the heart of the narrow inner city, Joseph received 100 impressions which confirmed the legend. Nobody looked at him and his. Strangers were the daily fare, and his companions were not crass enough in their strangeness to cause remark. He might gaze undisturbed, his only care being lest his spiritual pride be encroached upon by the sight of so great a world. Fear of falling prey to diffidence made him look with reserve on what he saw. And what all did he not see on the way from the harbor to the inn? What treasures of merchandise swelled the bazaars! How the streets teemed and seethed with every kind and breed of the children of Adam! All the citizenry of Weisei seemed to be on their legs, to be impelled to move from one end of the city to the other and back, while with these natives mingled human types and costumes from the four corners of the earth. By the landing stage there had been a noisy crowd about a group of ebony black Moors with incredibly thick, swollen lips and ostrich feathers on their heads, men and animal-eyed women with breasts like wineskins, and absurd children in baskets on their backs. The men were leading animals on chains, horribly whining panthers and baboons walking on all fours. A giraffe towered up, tall as a tree in front and like a horse behind. There were greyhounds, too, and the Moors carried bundles covered with cloth of gold, whose contents doubtless corresponded to the value of the wrapping. Probably it was gold and ivory. These, Joseph learned, were a tribute-bearing mission from the land of Cush, southwards beyond the land of Wewet, far up the river. Only a very small, non-compulsory and irregular tribute, sent by the governor of the southern lands, viceroy and prince of Cush, as a surprise for Pharaoh and to rejoice his heart, that he might be favorably mindful of the prince, and not take it into his head to recall him and replace him by one of the gentlemen in the royal entourage who had been dinning in Pharaoh's ears at every levee that the holder of the valuable office up the river was quite unworthy of his charge. The strange thing was that these harbor hands who gaped at the embassy, these street gamins who laughed at the palm tree neck of the giraffe, were perfectly informed about the inner history, the viceroy's anxiety, and the carping of Pharaoh's courtier. Joseph and the Ishmaelites heard them comment on these things in loud and certain tones. A pity, thought Joseph, that sophistication must mar their pure and simple pleasure in the picturesque spectacle. But perhaps it only added spice. He himself was glad to hear their talk. It was good to get a sidelight on such matters, to learn that the prince of Cush trembled for his office, that the courtiers intrigued against him, and that Pharaoh liked to be surprised. The knowledge strengthened his confidence and armed him against humility. The Negroes, in charge of Egyptian officials, were ferried over the river to stand before Pharaoh. Joseph watched them go. More of their color he saw as he made his way with his owners, but in fact he saw every shade of skin, from obsidian black through all the tones of brown and yellow to cheese white. He saw even yellow hair and bright blue eyes, faces and garments of every cut. He saw the human race. For the foreign ships with which Pharaoh traded very often did not stop in the ports of the Delta region, but sailed with the north wind upriver to unload their tribute of freight and goods for exchange on the spot whither everything came at last, namely Pharaoh's treasure house, that he might therewith enrich Amun and his friends, enabling the former to enlarge his demands in respect of building activities and surpass anything previously built. As for the friends, the gifts of Pharaoh refined their lives to the last degree, making them so fastidious that from refinement they fell indeed into foppery. These things the old man explained to Joseph. And thus it was Joseph saw, among the people of Waysay, Moors from Cush, Bedouins from the land of God, this side the Red Sea, pale-faced Libyans from the oases of the western desert, in gay woven skirts and plaits standing out straight from their heads, Amu people, and Asiatics like himself, in colored woolens, with the beards and noses of his own land, Hattite men from beyond the Amanus range, in tight shirts and with their hair in bags, Mitanni traders in the dignified fringed and draped garb of Babel, merchants and seafarers from the islands and from Mycenae, in white woolen robes with beautifully falling folds, wearing bronze rings on their bare arms. So much he saw, even though the old man modestly led his troop as much as possible through the poorer streets and avoided the finer quarters in order not to offend their beauty. But it was not possible to spare them quite. There was the beautiful street of Hansu, which ran parallel to the triumphal avenue of the god, the Street of the Sun, as it was called. Hans, related to the moon, was son of Amun and Mut, his Baalat. He was in Thebes what Nefertem, the Blue Lotus, was at Menfei, and with his exalted parents he made up the Triad of Weset. The street of Hans, then, was a main artery, a real Abrek avenue, where it was always well to take heed to one's heart. The Ishmaelites had to traverse it for a distance long enough to expose them to the full danger of its splendors. Joseph saw the ministries of the treasury, and the granaries, and the palace where the sons of Syrian city princes were brought up, wonderful and spacious erections of brick and fine woods, brilliant with colors. He saw chariots roll past, covered all over with hammered gold, wherein the lords of the earth stood and swung the lash over the backs of steeds, prancing and rolling their eyeballs, snorting fire from their nostrils and foam from their jaws. Their legs were like deer's legs. Their heads were drawn in on their chests and crowned with ostrich feathers. He saw sedan chairs pass, carried on shoulder poles in easy swinging tread by tall youths wearing gold aprons. The chairs were carven, gilded, and canopied, and men sat in them with their hands hidden in their garments, their lacquered hair stroked back from brow to neck, their eyelashes cast down, condemned by rank to immobility. At their backs, a screen of reeds and painted linen sheltered them from the wind. Who was it who one day should sit like that and be born before his house, which Pharaoh had enriched? That lies in the future. Our narrative has not yet reached that hour and feast, though where it lies, it is already present and known of all. For the time, Joseph, of course, only saw what he once would be, gazed upon it with eyes as large and strange as those which would rest on him or cringe before him, the foreign great man. Young slave Osarsif, son of the well, stolen and sold hither, in ragged shirt and hood, with dirty feet, pushed to the wall by soldiers who came dashing by in even, shining ranks, amid blare of trumpets, armed with shields, bows, and clubs, bristling with lances, down the street of the sun. He took these grim ranks for Pharaoh's soldiery, but by the standards and the insignia on the shields, the old man recognized that they were troops of the gods, temple soldiery, the strength of Amun. What? Thought Joseph. Had then Amun armies and bodies of soldiers like Pharaoh? He did not like it, and not wholly because the squad had pinned him to the wall. He was conscious of jealousy on Pharaoh's account, on account of the question who was the greatest here. The proximity of Amun's pride and fame, in any case, oppressed him. He took comfort in the presence of another highness, namely Pharaoh's own, and the thought that this idol rivaled him in his own field, that he even kept an army, angered him. He thought to guess that it angered Pharaoh, too, and took his side against the arrogant deity. But soon they left the Street of the Sun, not to mar it any longer, and by narrow lanes came to the inn called Sippar Court, because its owner and host was a Chaldean from Sippar on the Euphrates, and took by preference Chaldean folk to lodge, though all sorts of other folk as well. It was called a court because it was almost nothing but a well and courtyard, quite as full of dirt, noise, and smells, bleating of herds, quarreling of men, and squealing of mountebanks, as the inn at Menfei. And even that very evening the old man struck up a little trade and had a run of customers. They slept under their mantles, and had to take turns, all except the old man, in standing watch, lest valuables be stolen from the packs and treasures by their very doubtful fellow lodgers. They had to wait their turn to wash themselves at the well. Then they breakfasted on a sort of pap, which was served to them, a Chaldean dish prepared from sesame called papasu. At last the old man said, not looking at Joseph as he spoke, "Now then, my friends, thou, Mibsam, my son-in-law, Epher, my nephew, and Kedar and Kedema, my sons, we will leave here toward sunrise with our goods and offerings in the direction of the desert where the city leaves off among the dwellings of the great, for I have acquaintance there and folk with needs who I hope will be ready to buy from our packs this and that for their storehouses and to pay us so that we come not on our own cost but pocket a good advantage and enrich ourselves comfortably to our role as traders on this earth. Load then our goods upon the beasts, and saddle me mine, that I may lead the van." Thus it came about, and they drew out of Sippar Court toward the gardens of the rich. In front, Joseph led the old man's dromedary by a long rein.